And as we read, I want you to consider what is the diagnosis that he gives, but also what's his approach, right? What's the diagnosis? Well, how does he approach the people who are sick in this passage? John chapter 5, starting in verse 1, he says this: "After this was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool, in Aramaic called Bethesda, which has five roofed colonnades. In these lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. And one man was there who had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been there a long time, he said to him, 'Do you want to be healed?' The sick man answered him, 'Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up. And while I'm going, another steps down before me.' And Jesus said to him, 'Get up, take up your bed, and walk.' And at once the man was healed, and he took up his bed and walked. Now that day was a Sabbath, so the Jews said to the man who had been healed, 'It is the Sabbath, and it is not lawful for you to take up your bed.' But he answered them, 'The man who healed me, that man said to me, take up your bed and walk.' They asked him, 'Who is the man who said to you, take up your bed and walk?' Now the man who had been healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had withdrawn, as there was a crowd in that place. Afterward, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, 'See, you are well. Sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you.' The man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had healed him. And this was why the Jews were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, 'My Father is working until now, and I am working.' This was why the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him, because not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God." But one of the first things we see in this passage is, as Jesus plays the part of the great physician, is that he challenges. He challenges our view of desperation. And I realize kind of we've been walking through the book of James most Sundays. We're taking a break from that. We're jumping, you know, midway into John. So let me give you a little bit of context. Story picks up, and Jesus, we find him in verse 1, says he's in Jerusalem. There's a feast of the Jews, right? It's a time of celebration in the city of Jerusalem. And while he's there, he makes his way in verse 2 to a pool. It's called Bethesda, or the by the sheep gate. Liz and I had a chance to go to Israel this past spring, and what's incredible is this pool is still there. It's not filled with water anymore, but you can see where it would have been, and it was the place where they had washed all the animals before they got sacrificed in the temple. That's why it's called the sheep pool. It's where they would wash the sheep. So Jesus, in verse 2, he goes to the sheep pool. He goes to the pool of Bethesda, and John tells us in verse 3, there's a multitude of sick people, right? There's blind people, there's lame people, there's paralyzed people. And then he zooms in verse 5, on one particular person. And this is what John says. One man was there who had been an invalid for 38 years. Think about that for a moment. 38 years of being an invalid, or 38 years of being paralyzed or disabled. I know the college students, most of them are gone today. Most of us in this room, if you think about it, fall in the age range of somewhere between about 30 and 40. You average it out. And if that's true, then that means if you were this man who's 38 years of being disabled, of being an invalid, that means your whole life you would be struggling, you would be dealing with your disability. Like if you were to walk in this man's shoes, that means you couldn't just hop in your car and go to Target or go to Giant whenever you wanted to pick something up. It means you'd probably be dependent on other people, probably be on some type of government financial support. It means you wouldn't just be able to run around with your kids after church and play with them outside in the snow. And it probably means, if you were in this culture, that you wouldn't even have kids because you wouldn't be married in the first place, because disabled people were considered outcasts. That's what life would have been like for this man that John highlights for us. And if you kind of start to put yourself in his shoes, then you can understand that the next thing John tells us in verse 6 is so shocking. Because look at how Jesus responds to this man. It says, when Jesus saw the man lying there and knew that he had already been there a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be healed?" Jesus, isn't it obvious? Of course this man wants to be healed. What kind of question is that? Jesus, that's, in medical speak, that's almost medical malpractice to ask a patient, "Do you want to get better?" How about you guys? I've never been to a doctor's office or a hospital visit where the doctor has questioned my desire to get better. They may have questioned whether or not I was sick, but they never questioned whether or not I want to get better. And yet Jesus asked the man, "Do you want to be healed? Do you want to be healed?" What is Jesus doing? What is Jesus doing? Well, before you write Jesus off, think about this. If you're the man and you had that question asked of you, you would think there'd be but one answer. Jesus, of course I want to be healed. Look at me. But notice what John tells us. Look at verse 7, what this man says. He says, "Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up. And while I'm going, another steps down before me." So Jesus asked the man, "Do you want to be healed?" And rather than say, "Yes, I want to be healed," the man kind of almost makes a list of reasons why he's not better yet. He kind of makes a list of excuses. He says things like, "Jesus, a man in my condition is not easily healed." He says things like, "You know, there's no one to help me. Every time I try to get in the water, there's no one around to help me in." And part of that's probably true. You know, I don't know what life would have been like for this man. I'm sure it was difficult to get help. I'm sure that he did feel alone at times. But you see Jesus here, the one who can look into men's hearts and men's motives and men's minds, and he asks the question. You almost get the sense, after 38 years of being an invalid, right? That's over 13,000 days. You almost have to start to wonder, does this man actually want to get better? Does he actually want to be healed? And I think it's an appropriate question for us this morning, because part of what Jesus is showing us in this passage, the reason he challenges our view of desperation, is because I think you and I think we're often content being sick. I think you and I, we're often content being sick. I mean, consider your past week for a moment, right? Think about maybe areas of your life where you have been prone to give into temptation, or you've just recognized patterns of sin in your life. You know, maybe for you, as you think about it, you've realized just your kind of your tendency to laziness, to kind of put off the things that need to get done and to do the things that really don't need to get done. And you're like, "I just want to be out of that. I don't want to be lazy anymore." Or maybe for you, it's indulging your mind in fantasies that you shouldn't be going down those paths, or with your eyes. Or maybe what comes to mind is just the tendency to either explode in anger or to kind of clam up when you feel misunderstood or when you feel hurt by another person. Whatever the pattern of sin or whatever the temptation is, if Jesus were here this morning and he were to ask you, "Do you want to be healed of that? Do you want to be free from that?" How would you respond? I think most of us would, initially we would say, "Of course, yes, I want to be freed from that. Yes, I want to be healed from that." But I think at the same time, there would be a rebellion against that in our heart that said, "No, I actually don't want to be healed because I like the benefits that sin gives me." Or you might not want to go there because in your mind, you know, as you think about your sin, you say, I can stop anytime I want. Or it's not that bad. Or you see the hard work and the energy required to actually get out of that sin. You're like, I don't want to go there. And so we there's this ambivalence, right? We would say yes, but I think at the same time we would say no. And I think that's what's going on with this man, that Jesus asked him, "Do you want to be healed?" It's because Jesus knows that there's a comfort, there's a contentment in his sickness. I know for me recently, God has been convicting me just how I use sleep to be lazy. So Liz and I were campus missionaries. That means we don't have a typical 9-to-5 job. I don't have to be up at 6 in the morning to get to work and drive 22 and be stuck in traffic and get to. And so part of what that means is I can sleep till 9 if I want. Not saying I should, but I can. And recently, God has just been convicting me that I don't need that much sleep, but I stay in bed because it's easier, right? It's a cozy. Who doesn't like a cozy, warm bed in the morning? And there are items on my to-do list that I'd rather just avoid, because I don't want to think about them, because they're going to be hard. If I stay in bed, I don't have to deal with them, at least for a while. And God's been convicting me of this, and there's this kind of this fork in the road, because I see the path to freedom where I'm like, man, if I just kill the laziness and get up in the morning, I'll have more time to spend in God's word. I'll have probably more energy for my work. I'll have more time to disciple men and women on campus. But there's part of me that sees the cost. Right? If I get up earlier, it means I need to start going to bed earlier. It means I'm probably going to miss out on some fun that could be had if I stay up late and hang out with people. It means I actually have to do the kind of the heart analysis on myself of why I'm so anxious and worried about the things in the to-do list that I often avoid. And I see a lot of reasons to say, no, Jesus, I don't want to be healed from this. I'd rather just live in my laziness. And I think that God, what he's showing me, he's helped me to make some big strides in it, but I think I'm just more and more convinced that I, at least personally, am content just being sick. It's just easier. And if you're similar, if you feel like, man, I'm just comfortable living in my sin, if you're like, I'm not sure what that looks like, here's some questions you could ask yourself. Here's kind of do some work on your heart this week. Ask yourself, where do I tend to make excuses or blame people or circumstances for my behavior? Or you can ask this, what areas of my life do I work hard at covering up so that people don't see the real me? Could shed light onto how you're content in being sick. I think one of the best things Jesus does in this passage as a very skillful and loving physician is he reminds us that we really are sick. We're really in need of rescue. And that if he didn't do that, we'd live the rest of our life like this man, just constantly laying by the pool, laying in our sin, laying in our sickness, so close to the cure and yet so far away. So Jesus, he challenges our view of desperation. But notice that's not all he does. The story doesn't end in verse 9, right? If it ended in verse 9, it'd kind of be this little cute story. Jesus finds a sick man. He does heal the man. We're not really going to talk about how he heals him, but he does heal the man. But the story continues. And I think why it continues is that he doesn't just challenge our view of desperation. He reveals to us the depths of our sickness. He shows us how sick we are. Notice where John goes in verse 10. It says, so the Jews, in other words, the religious leaders, the authorities in Jerusalem, said to the man who had been healed, it is the Sabbath, and it is not lawful for you to take up your bed. But he answered them, the man who healed me, that man said to me, take up your bed and walk. And they asked him, who is the man who said to you, take up your bed and walk? And so here you have this man, this invalid who's been disabled for 38 years. He's miraculously healed. And the first people he runs into are the Jewish religious leaders, right? And the first reaction he gets is one where they are party poopers. I mean, look what they say. They say, you're not allowed to carry your sleeping bag around. It's the Sabbath. Really? That's their reaction. This guy has just been miraculously healed of a life of suffering and embarrassment and shame and outcast after 38 years, and they respond, oh, you're breaking the rules. What's going on? I mean, why is this section in John 5? It almost kind of doesn't seem to fit. It's not just a simple, you know, passage about Jesus healing a man, but I think it really ties in. Because what John is doing us is he's showing us there's not just one sick person in this story. There's actually two. Actually two sick people. And what John is doing is he's trying to teach us something very important. He's showing us, right, the first guy who we talked about, he's incredibly sick, but he's almost just content in being sick. He doesn't realize how desperate he is. But the other people in the story, right, these religious leaders, the Jews, the Pharisees, They're sick, but they don't even realize it. They don't even realize it. And what John is showing us, here's the application. You and I, we can deceive ourselves into thinking we're healthy, into thinking, you know, we're tight with God by keeping the rules. We can deceive ourselves by keeping the rules. And that's what John shows us in verse 10, right? These morally upright people, the Jewish leaders, they look great on the outside. You know, they're the ones that have the Bible verses memorized. They don't miss a Sunday at church. And yet they're deceived. I mean, look at their life. Look at the progression that John walks us through about how they go from bad to worse. Verse 10. He describes this judgmental and unthankful and critical attitude toward this man who's been healed. Rather than celebrate with this guy, they use it as an opportunity to put the spotlight on themselves about how they have been doing great about keeping their rules. And then you jump down to verse 16, and you see that their life is filled with anger. And their life is filled with envy. They actually begin to persecute and threaten Jesus. Why? Because he's healing people. And then it gets even worse. Verse 18, at the very end, says they actually entertain the thought and begin to plot killing Jesus. It says they were seeking all the more to kill Jesus. And I think part of what John is doing here, part of what we're meant to see, is that you can actually fool yourself into thinking that you are spiritually healthy by keeping the rules. And see, but in reality, if you just keep the rules and you never get to the heart, the sin inside of you, the sickness inside of you, actually you give it the chance to fester and to do its work, that by the time you realize it's destroyed you. And so John takes us here. So let me ask you, are you the kind of person who's very inclined to keep the rules but avoid getting to your heart? Are you the kind of person to keep the rules? And they don't have to be Bible rules that you keep. It doesn't have to be the Ten Commandments. It can be rules that you make up. You know, maybe you keep the rule where, you know, you keep your house and your yard just immaculate so that when people look at your life, they think that your life is in order. And they don't see the mess that happens inside the home. Keeping a rule to disguise the real you. Or maybe at your job, you work hard, you put in hours upon hours, and you're disciplined in your work, but then at home, you almost use that as an excuse, or in your neighborhood, to not have to be outward focused and to share the gospel with your neighbors or other people. Do you use your work as a rule? I know for me, I often use timeliness as a rule, right? I want to be to time to places. I want to be timely in getting back to people. The people, I almost kind of come across as a person who has their life very ordered. That if I'm timely on the outside, maybe my relationship with God is ordered as well. It's a rule that I keep to disguise the real me. Jesus says, be careful if you're the kind of person who keeps rules, who keeps systems. It could mean that you're a deceived person. It could mean that you haven't gotten to the real issue. That's why Jesus goes here. That's why he brings up this kind of snippet about the Jewish leaders. And you almost wonder, as you read this passage, who's more sick? Who's more sick in the passage? Is it the first guy who's been an invalid for 38 years? Or is it the Jewish leaders? Who's more sick? I think both are sick. Both are just as sick. It's, you know, it's like the first guy, it's like he has Ebola, but he thinks he just has a common cold. Right? He doesn't realize how desperate he is. But then the second group of people, these Jewish leaders who are keeping the rules, who are making it all about them, it's almost as if they have cancer, but they think they're Olympian athletes. They're deceived. One guy's not desperate enough. The other people are deceived. Who's worse off? I don't know. Ebola or cancer, both are going to kill you if you do nothing about them. Which is why Jesus is so loving in what he does. In verse 14, notice what he tells this man. He finds this man afterward, And he says to the man, see, you are well. You look great on the outside now. You're jumping around. You're walking. You're even at the temple, presumably doing something religious. I don't know, praying. Sin no more. Sin no more that nothing worse may happen to you. In other words, you've been paralyzed physically for 38 years. But don't neglect the most important issue, your very sin. Because if you neglect that, if you cover over that, you'll actually experience something called spiritual paralysis, which is being separated from God for all of eternity with no means to get back. Don't miss the biggest thing, your sin. If you miss that, you actually miss everything. There's a woman, most of you guys probably have heard of her, Johnny Erickson Tada. You guys heard of this woman? She, if you don't know her story, when she was 17, she had an accident. She had she dove into the I think a lake, and it was too shallow. She didn't judge the water right, and she ended up hitting her head and became a quadriplegic. And since then, the Lord has used her disability, has used her accident to really give her a voice with people. So she goes around and shares the gospel with all different kinds of people, disabled people, young people, old people. And this is part of what she said in her autobiography. She's speaking to a group of young people, and I think she just captures what Jesus is getting at here, right? Don't look at the outside. Deal with the real issue. Deal with your sin. This is what she tells a group of young adults. She says, "Wouldn't it be exciting if right now, in front of you, I could be miraculously healed? Get up out of my chair and on my feet. What a miracle. We'd all be excited and praising God. It'd be something we could confirm for ourselves. We'd actually see the wonder and the power of God. Wouldn't that be thrilling?" I was speaking to an audience of about 1,600 young people. And I paused as they visualized the scene. And I continued, "But far more exciting and wonderful in the long run would be the miracle of your salvation. The healing of your own soul. You see, that's more exciting because that's something that will last forever. If my body were suddenly and miraculously healed, I'd be on my feet another 30, 40 years, and then my body would die. But the soul lives for eternity." She goes on to say, "From the standpoint of eternity, my body is only a flicker in the time span of forever." Do you catch what Johnny is saying? He's saying, right, I could be miraculously healed, but that would in no way compare to you guys being spiritually healed. And what Jesus does in this passage, first, it's almost as if he comes into the waiting room. He comes with his notebook and his pad, and he questions whether or not we think we're sick. Then he goes to the examination. He brings us back into his office. He shows us the charts. He shows us the tests, and he reveals how sick we really are. But he doesn't leave us there. He offers us a cure. What we see in the passage, Jesus offers us an unlikely cure. And I think it's a reason, like Bruce said this morning, it is a reason for hope. It is a reason for hope this morning. Jesus offers us an unlikely cure. And this is how he does it. First, he initiates. And then he follows up. And lastly, he trades places with us. We'll just walk through them and then we'll end. Jesus, we see he initiates. Look all the way back to verse 1. Look at what it says. After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. So there's a feast in Jerusalem. People are partying. People are celebrating. People were with family. People are delighting in God. Where is Jesus? Is he in the palace? No. Is he with the influencers and movers and shakers of society? Not there. Is he with his family? Nope. Notice where he is. He's in the hospital. He's at the pool of Bethesda where all the disabled people would lie. Jesus, during the feast, goes to the hospital. And I think this is so encouraging because this is what it means. Jesus doesn't wait for us to get our act together before he'll heal us. Jesus doesn't wait for us to come to him before he'll help us. Jesus initiates. Jesus comes to us. I mean, look at verse 8. How much faith did the guy have to be healed? How would you quantify the faith of the invalid? He didn't have any faith. If anything, he screwed it up. I mean, look at what he does. He throws himself a pity party. He makes excuses. And on top of that, by the end of the story, he tattletales on Jesus to the religious leaders. And you could argue that him doing that actually led to Jesus being crucified. This guy screws it up. And yet Jesus heals him. Jesus takes the initiative and he heals him on the spot. What does this mean for us? You feel like so far you've been reading the passage and you just feel discouraged. You're like 2/3 of this thing so far. I just feel hopeless. Be encouraged. Be encouraged because Jesus loves healing people who bring nothing to the table. And you say, okay, well, I don't even feel like I have enough faith to approach God. Like, I don't even feel like I have enough faith this morning based on where I've been the past week and kind of just emotionally how I'm doing. I don't feel like I can even just start a conversation with God. And lovingly, I would say, too bad. Because the man in the story doesn't have any faith, and yet Jesus heals him. think what John is showing us is that Jesus loves initiating with people. Jesus always takes the first step. In fact, the Bible later on tells us that our faith is a gift from God, that Jesus has to actually give us the faith that we have. So don't try to well it up in your heart. Jesus initiates. But notice that's not all he does. Jesus doesn't just initiate, he follows up. Verse 14. It says, afterward, Jesus found the man in the temple and said to him, see, you are well, sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you. You know, I've heard of doctors scheduling follow-up appointments to see how you're doing, to make sure you're progressing and getting better. I've never, ever heard of a doctor, ever, tracking you down at Target while you're running errands to see how you're doing. And yet that's what Jesus does in the story. Jesus tracks the man down to follow up with him. It implies, when it says Jesus found him, it implies that Jesus was looking for him. Jesus was looking for him. He was intent on following up. Why does Jesus follow up? Here's why Jesus follows up. He says, see, you are well, sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you. He says, you look great on the outside, but let's not fool ourselves. That was just the initial appointment. Don't forget that there's something deeper going on. That the sin inside of you will destroy you if you don't do something about it. And so Jesus follows up with this man because, like a skillful and precise surgeon, he is faithful and he is committed to cutting out every last bit of cancer. It's called sin. That's why he follows up. And Jesus, I think, does the same thing with us. Friends, God is committed. You want to use Bible speak. He's committed to our holiness. He's committed to our becoming like Jesus. That's why if you're sitting here this morning and you would say, you know, Brian, I am a Christian. I do identify with believing in Christ. It's probably why you see more of your sin as time goes on than less sin. You say, I thought this whole Christianity thing, I thought you're supposed to get better. I thought you're supposed to become less sinful as you know Jesus. And you do, but part of what happens is that Jesus reveals more and more of the depths of our sin. Why it seems like you become more sinful. One theologian says it this way, till your sin becomes bitter, Christ will not be sweet. Till your sin becomes bitter, Christ will not be sweet. So part of the process of becoming like Jesus is God faithfully showing you more and more of your sin that you can repent of it and come to Christ and be healed of it. And he's faithful to do it. It's also why if maybe you're not sure where you stand with God this morning, if you'd say, you know, I'm starting to investigate this whole Bible thing, but I wouldn't necessarily say I'm a Christian yet or that I want to be. Part of the way Jesus and God follows up with you is he gives you a conscience, right? He gives you kind of the intrinsic ability to know what's right and wrong. It's part of why God brings pesky Christians into your life. You're like, why do these, I always feel like I run into Christians. God's doing it. He's trying to bring people in your life that it will encourage you to go see the doctor. To go see the great physician. That's why, regardless of where you stand before God this morning, if you're a Christian, if you're not a Christian, if you don't know where you are, it's why God has purposely structured the world so it will not work according to your plan. This week coming up will not work the way you think it will. Things will go wrong, tires will go flat, people will disappoint you, you'll get sick, gadgets will break. The reason God purposely doesn't just allow that to happen, but can cause it to happen, is to get our attention. That something is wrong with the world. That something is wrong with us. To encourage us to go see the great physician. So Jesus follows up. Jesus initiates. There's one more thing that Jesus does as he offers us the unlikely cure. I think this is the most incredible part. It says he trades places with us. He trades places with us. You know, when God looks at us, he sees us in our sick condition and our sin. He doesn't neglect us. He doesn't quarantine us. Right? He doesn't pull the plug. He draws near to us. But even more than drawing near to us, he doesn't just empathize with us. He doesn't just listen and say it'll be okay. He actually does something about it. He trades places with us such that he takes our junk. He takes our sin, he takes our lust, he takes our anger and our disappointment, he takes our frustrations, he takes our bitterness and our impatience, all the things that we would say, I want to be free from those things. He takes all that junk and he places it onto himself. And then as the great physician who has the perfect medical records, he takes his love, he takes his patience, he takes his kindness, and he puts it on us. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verse 20 says it this way. It says, God who made him, Jesus Christ, who had no sin, to be sin for us. Why? So that in him we might become the righteousness of God. God made Jesus to be sin so that you and I who are sinful, who deserve God's righteous judgment because of our sin, might be viewed as perfect and delightful in God's sight. Friends, that if that's not a reason to hope on Advent Sunday, I don't know what it is. God offers us the package deal as he cures us. That's what John is talking about in verse 17. Notice this idea of Sabbath. You know, you read the Bible, and you know Jesus is kind of quirky at times. He doesn't often do the things you'd expect. You sometimes wonder, why does Jesus heal on the Sabbath? It causes the Jews to get all fussed up. Why does he heal on the Sabbath? Like, of all the days that Jesus could have healed the man, he's been an invalid for 38 years, why couldn't he have just waited till Tuesday? Why pick the most controversial day to heal the man? Because God doesn't waste words and he doesn't waste moments. Jesus intentionally picks the Sabbath to show us that he is at work to bring true rest. That's what he says in verse 17. That he is still working, even to this day, to bring rest. In other words, the very candle that's lit in front of you, this symbol that celebrates Advent, the coming, the anticipation of Jesus, what Jesus is showing us, even in John 5, is that from the day of his birth to the moment of his death, Jesus has been at work perfectly obeying and pleasing his Father, such that the blessing and the reward and the privilege that perfection would earn him might be given to us, might be transferred to those who deserve separation from God. That's what Jesus does. He trades places with us. He offers us healing. He offers us true rest. Do you believe that? Is that good news to you this morning? Do you see yourself as a person who is desperately sinful, but that there is a cure that is far abundant than any sickness you can have? Do you believe that? You know, if somebody were to ask you during the bagel hour in 20 minutes, how are you doing? Would you be inclined just to say, I'm doing fine? When there's real stuff under the surface, going on at home, going on at work, going on with your kids, where you would say, man, I'm a lot more sick than I would like to own up to. Jesus says, you don't need to cover up. You don't need to fake it. You don't need to disguise it. Because why? Because the great physician sees the real you and promises to cure you from whatever is going on inside the real you. That's the unlikely cure that Jesus offers. Friends, if you're here this morning and you feel like, man, I feel like I've just been avoiding God. I feel like I've just been avoiding others. Be encouraged to approach God. He's already taken the initiative with you. Let him heal you. Let him help you. Let him cure you of whether you think it's a minor thing or a major thing. He came to forgive both. Question is, I think it's an appropriate one that we can end on, is this: do you want to be healed? Do you want to be healed this morning? Jesus offers it, but he never forces it.